I'm Margaret Brennan, and this is In Business.
Tony Hayward is out. Bob Dudley is in.
Loads of economic data coming out this week. Breaking news just crossing.
One of the icons on Wall Street. He joins me here.
Watch In Business weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
This is Lewis Lapham with the World in Time for October 8th. My guest is Jonathan Schneer, professor of history at Georgia Tech, speaking with us today about the Balfour Declaration. In your book of that title, Jonathan, you describe the political and diplomatic maneuvering that in 1917 resulted in a document that in the years since has come to be regarded by both Arabs and Jews as the cause of their ongoing war in Palestine. Where was it written and who wrote it?
It was written in London. It was written in the days before November 2, 1917, which is to say in the midst of World War I, when the British were by no means certain that they could win the war. It was written by a team of people, first by Zionists who had been in touch with members of the government. It was then given to members of the government who themselves improved it in different ways. I don't think you could say that Arthur Balfour was the primary author of the Balfour Declaration.
Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary.
Yes.
And he released the declaration in a letter to whom?
To Lord Rothschild, who was the sort of titular head of the British Jewish community and who was also, had become in the last few years, a convinced Zionist.
You begin your book with a description of Palestine prior to World War I, before the enormous changes have taken place over the last century. Describe Palestine in 1914.
It was a wild land inhabited by not three-quarters of a million people. The vast majority were poor agricultural laborers. Some were wandering Bedouin tribesmen and women, of course. It was governed very loosely from Damascus by representatives of the Ottoman Empire, whose capital was in Constantinople. The Ottoman Empire is, of course, the Turkish Empire.
The ratio of Jews to Arabs?
Something like 8 or 9 to 1 in favor of the Arabs.
World War I puts Palestine in play in war objectives on the part of the great powers. Give us some notion of the stakes as seen by the British and by the French and by the Germans.
The British had a long-standing interest in the Middle East because they controlled the Suez Canal. They had to control the Suez Canal because it was Britain's economic windpipe, jugular vein. So they could not be indifferent to anything going on near the Suez Canal, which meant they could not be indifferent to who controlled Palestine. North of Palestine, the French had long-standing economic interests in Syria and Lebanon, and of course also along the North African coast they did as well. So for many, many years, they sort of watched carefully as the Ottoman Empire slowly lost its grip on its possessions in the Middle East and elsewhere. I guess to further explain the geopolitical situation in 1914, the Russians had a long-standing interest in expanding to the east, in taking Constantinople. They wanted especially to be able to get from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean Sea, and that was why they wanted to take Constantinople, which stands at the choke point there at the Sea of Marmara in the Straits of the Dardanelles. They had fought several wars to try to get it. They never were allowed to get it, even when they won the wars. But when World War I began, the Russians were marching upon Constantinople. The British and the French could not have been very happy at the prospect of Russian vessels in the Mediterranean Sea. But on the other hand, Russia was very important to them as an ally in the war against Germany.
The British develop a policy toward Arabs and a policy toward Zionists at more or less the same time as a consequence of World War I. What is the British imperial objective?
First of all, not an imperial objective per se, is to win the war. But to do that and to maintain and extend the British Empire, I suppose, they needed to throw against the Ottomans, who had become their enemy, every weapon they could think of. That meant, first of all, that they got into touch with the Grand Sharif Hussein of Mecca, who nurtured ambitions of his own, and they basically said, will you support us in the war? Will you engage in a rebellion against the Ottomans? And so the Grand Sharif Hussein of Mecca embarked upon a very sort of dangerous game of courting the British while the British were courting him. The British wanted him to attack their common enemy, the Ottomans.
The British make the promise of Palestine to the Arabs in return for their ally in World War I.
Well, it's not quite that clear-cut. They certainly promised to support establishment of an independent Arab kingdom after the war, of which Hussein would be the leader. That is absolutely clear and indisputable.
And of which Palestine would be a part.
Well, that's the part that has divided historians and has divided partisans ever since. The letters to Hussein from the British are ambiguous, and they were intentionally ambiguous. But they certainly allowed Hussein to believe that Palestine would be part of this independent post-war Arab kingdom.
Meanwhile, what kind of promises are the British making to the Zionists?
Well, the Zionists in Britain conducted a remarkable campaign in which first they persuaded the British leadership, who were most of them quite willing to be persuaded, that international Jewry represented a vast subterranean power in the world, and they allowed them to draw the conclusion that Britain must have it if it wanted to win the war, must have it on its side. Then they persuaded the British leadership that the vast majority of Jews were Zionists and were longing for a restoration of their ancient homeland, Palestine, so that the British drew the next logical conclusion: to gain the support of this vast subterranean power in the world, they must promise Palestine to the Jewish people, hence the Balfour Declaration, and that is quite unambiguous.
But there is also a division of opinion among British Jews as to the value of a promised land in Palestine.
Yes. In 1914, the British population was over 40 million. The Jewish British population was 300,000, and the Zionist British Jews numbered 8,000. In other words, they're a tiny minority. So the vast majority of British Jews are not Zionists. That's number one. Number two, the leadership of the Jewish community was definitely anti-Zionist. The leadership, composed mainly of quite wealthy assimilated Jews, believed that Jews share a common belief system which can be practiced anywhere, but that they do not represent a distinct nation, a distinct people. And moreover, they argued that the Zionists were opening Jews to the charge of dual loyalty. That is to say, if the real homeland for the Jewish people was Palestine, then what were they doing in Britain or in France or in the United States or Canada? So they thought that Zionism would give anti-Semites a handle.
A Jewish homeland in Palestine was a shuffling off of the Jews to a ghetto.
One of them said something like, Palestine will become the world's ghetto. That's right. That's what they believed. I'm not saying that's quite what the British government believed, but it is certainly what the so-called assimilationist Jews in Britain believed.
Prior to 1914, there had been some movement among British Zionists and support in the British government for a Jewish homeland in Africa. Is that so?
Yes. This was an issue that divided Jews from all over the world. The founder of the Zionist movement was an Austrian journalist named Herzl, and he came to believe that since Palestine was not going to be obtainable in the near future, the Jews should consider going somewhere else, at least for the time being. And this issue divided the World Federation of Zionists, and it also badly divided British Jewish Zionists. And there was a contingent led by an author named Israel Zangwill, who believed fervently that the Jews should go anywhere to escape from Russia and Romania and the pogroms in those places until Palestine became available.
But it's World War I that provides the opportunity. I mean, most of the events in your book take place between 1914 and the signing of the Declaration in 1917. So it's the war that presents opportunities to both the Arabs and the Zionists.
Precisely, because the British Zionists realize right away, of course the war is a catastrophe for the world and a catastrophe for all peoples, including Jewish peoples. However, Turkey is now an enemy of Great Britain. Therefore, if Turkey can be defeated and the Ottoman Empire can be divided up, then Palestine can become a British protectorate, and then the British will allow the Jews to emigrate into Palestine in vast numbers. And so British Zionists, by and large, become fervent supporters of the British government's war effort. They wanted a war to the end in order to defeat the Ottoman Empire.
And the Balfour Declaration is composed by the War Cabinet, so it comes out of war aims and it's released by Balfour, the Foreign Secretary. But you also say your book is filled with intrigue and deceit and ambiguity. You also say that the British mislead the Arabs, mislead the Zionists, and even after the Balfour Declaration, they're trying to make a deal with the Turks.
Yes, because they were thinking, the British government was thinking, how are we going to win this war? And in fact, if they could have arranged a secret peace agreement with the Ottoman Empire, that would have done more for the British war effort than anything the Jews or the Arabs could do. Once Lloyd George became prime minister in December of 1916, he always kept an eye on this sort of eastern theater of the war, and he opened various back channels to the Turks. Some of them, the War Cabinet was well aware and informed about. I think the most important, the War Cabinet knew nothing, and that was when Lloyd George chose as his emissary the most infamous arms dealer of the period. His name was Basil Zaharoff, and he used this man to actually speak to one of the Turkish leaders, Enver, about getting Britain out of the war. Getting Turkey out of the war. And the most amazing part about this aspect of things is that part of the inducement held out to the Turks to quit fighting was that if they did so, the Turkish flag would be allowed to continue to fly over most of its Middle Eastern possessions, including Palestine. And they made this offer, Lloyd George through Zaharoff made this offer in January of 1918, which is to say 2 months after the Balfour Declaration had been made public.
I'm going to read the first few words of the Balfour Declaration. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. In your book, you say that this is the sowing of the dragon's teeth that have led to steady escalating conflict over the last 100-odd years.
Yes. The Jewish people have seen the Balfour Declaration as the foundation stone of modern Israel, and ever since 1917, and in fact held a massive celebration in December, a month later, precisely marking this passage, because one of the great powers had given its imprimatur to their movement. And of course, for the obvious reason, Arab people have viewed it ever since as the foundation stone of their dispossession and misery.
Did the British War Cabinet have any idea what they were doing?
Yes, I think so.
But not the sowing of the dragon's teeth.
Well, one of the members of the War Cabinet, Lord Curzon, said something to the effect that he could not imagine that the Arab people in Palestine would consent to become the hewers and wood and drawers of water for Jewish transplants, something like that. The one Jewish member of the cabinet, not himself a member of the War Cabinet, but included in the discussions about the Balfour Declaration, was named Edwin Montagu. He was then sent off to become the Viceroy of India, or at any rate, an important figure in India for the British. And he was deeply opposed to it, although I don't know that he foresaw what was coming, but he did think that it would cause trouble between Jews and Arabs.
Well, on that ironic note, in what is playing out as an ironic tragedy, thank you, Jonathan Schneer, for speaking with us today about the Balfour Declaration. This is Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2010.